You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Fight the Empire with host Per Fagering, speaking today with journalist Robert Perry.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering. The show is Fight the Empire, and we have a very special guest today. It's Robert Perry, who is a veteran journalist and author, and he's the publisher of Consortium News, which is a great website, good articles, and you can get some of his books through that website. And Robert Perry, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Per. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a today is a big day in Scotland. They're voting on whether to separate from the United Kingdom. At the same time, the U.S. is all bent out of shape over these separatists in eastern Ukraine. So what's going on here?
Well, it does seem to be a little bit of a double standard. The the traditional American view on nation states is that it really is up to the people being governed, that people should have a right to separate when they find that necessary. Obviously, not for frivolous reasons. That's how the United States was formed, in effect, by separating from Great Britain at the time. So you have that as a fundamental principle of the United States, and one that the U.S. has supported in recent years in places like Kosovo and South Sudan, and certainly recognizing the breakup of the Soviet Union a couple decades ago. But when it comes to areas that where it goes against what the United States wants for geopolitical reasons, it seems like the rules change.
Yeah, I saw a very interesting video a while ago. It was a 1 minute video showing all of the border changes in Europe and Russian area over the last 1,000 years. So you see all these different empires and nation states kind of arise and expand and disappear, and it's just so you get an idea of just how borders change all the time.
Well, obviously you don't want that to happen too much, because it can lead to wars, and it's only contributed to World War One and World War Two. And so that was the principle of trying to keep countries together, I think, makes sense, and people should not secede for temporal or superficial reasons. But there are times in extreme situations where it makes sense, and the United States has respected that even in recent years. But when it came to the point when Ukraine was going through this essentially a collapse of its constitutional system in February, where the elected president was overthrown, a new regime took over. It showed hostility toward the Russian speakers in the east and south. And that contributed to the Crimeans, who had always seen themselves as being Russian, at least back for the last few hundred years, that they decided to get out of this failed state. They seceded and sought permission to join the Russian Federation, which was accepted, and they were annexed. And that seemed, in some ways, like the will of the people of Crimea. Certainly, when they had a referendum, there was 90-some percent support. But in the Western press and from the view of the U.S. government, that was aggression, and it sort of fed this almost a new Cold War that's taken shape over what seems like a relatively minor matter, which is where should the Crimeans have their national allegiance, either to Ukraine or to Russia, and if they chose Russia, suddenly it became this huge thing that had to prompt a virtual confrontation between nuclear powers, between the NATO and Russia.
Well, it looks to me that when it comes to Ukraine, the West kind of really stepped in it. It's something very goofy about Victoria Nuland handing out cookies on Maidan Square, and just I don't know, just see something really kind of weird about how this whole thing blew up all of a sudden. And did they think it would be easy or something, or what?
Well, it's a good question. I just the other day I was rereading the transcript of that intercepted phone call where the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, who's a prominent neocon who's remained and actually risen during the Obama administration at the State Department. And she was speaking with the fairly neocon-oriented ambassador, Jeffrey Pyatt, and they were discussing, this is in early February, they were discussing the overthrow of the elected government of Ukraine, who they were going to put in, who should not be part of this government, who they wanted. Pyatt used the word midwifing this new regime. And indeed, the person that Victoria Nuland had picked, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, turned out after the president was overthrown, President Yanukovych was overthrown, he indeed ends up being prime minister and being sort of the one of the major leaders of the new government. So you do see this in a fairly direct way how this plan for regime change was playing out. And it was something that the West initiated. The biggest myth about this Ukraine crisis is that Putin initiated this, that he was trying to somehow recreate the Soviet Union or recapture the Russian Empire. That's just not supported by the facts. The facts are that Putin was trying to maintain the status quo in Ukraine. He was trying to support the elected president, Yanukovych, and keep their constitutional system in play. It was only because first the EU and the United States sought to pull Ukraine out of what they consider the Russian sphere into the European sphere. They wanted to change the status quo. It was really the West that initiated, that threw the first punch, if you will. But the way it's been presented in the American news media and by the U.S. government has been the opposite. They've been claiming that this was a case of Russian aggression. All we hear about is this unsupported claim that this was part of some larger scheme of Putin's to take back the Baltic states. There's just no evidence of that, and in fact, the evidence all goes the other way.
You know, I have to say the media coverage of this has been really terrible, and I'm including NPR. It's just it's so one-sided, and it's just it really boggles. I haven't seen anything like this for a long time. And
yeah, either way, and I've covered Washington for the mainstream press mostly going back to the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been some very bad examples of poor coverage of stories, I should say, during that time, most notably, I guess, the Iraq War in 2002-2003. But this has been kind of special. It's been so thoroughly one-sided in the treatment, and that's not just Fox News or it goes across the spectrum. The New York Times has been one of the worst offenders of journalistic ethics in how it's presented this story. The Washington Post has been pretty wretched. MSNBC has just followed the mainstream of themes, which have not reflected, in many cases, the truth. But almost more significantly, they've not really presented the two sides, the different or the various sides of the struggle. They've treated the eastern Ukrainians as if they're just pawns of Moscow, automatons being propagandized and lied to. They've made the western Ukrainians seem like the white hats, even though we know that that among them are these very these what they call nationalists, but they actually are neo-Nazi groups. So you've had this effort by the American press to present a black and white story when it's been a much gray story.
Is this what they call the Washington consensus?
Yeah, the conventional wisdom, groupthink. I think it's really been more of groupthink. And one of the odd things is after the Iraq War, people said, oh, we saw what happened. Yes, there was this groupthink that took hold. We all thought that Saddam must have had weapons of mass destruction because we all told each other that, and all the think tanks said it, and everyone, you know, so we didn't rethink independently, and we won't do that again, except that the press just keeps doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, I trace it to the fact that after the Iraq disaster, there was very, very little accountability. either in the government or in the Washington Press Corps. Maybe with the exception of Judy Miller of the New York Times, nobody lost a job. And some of the same people that got those stories wrong, people like Michael Gordon, for instance, of the New York Times, who co-wrote the famous story with Judy Miller about the aluminum tubes that turned out to be not at all what they thought on Iraq, Michael Gordon is still a, quote, respected journalist writing about Ukraine and also getting things wrong on that almost the same way. And at the Washington Post, you have people like Fred Hyatt, who was the executive page editor back during the Iraq War fiasco, getting everything wrong then, and he's still the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, getting things wrong now. So without any accountability, it's very hard to have any serious lessons learned. So it probably shouldn't be a surprise, as shocking and depressing as it is, to see the same groupthink take hold on something as significant as Ukraine, where you have the a potential new Cold War being fomented, as you saw a decade or so ago over Iraq.
Well, this makes you, you know, I wanted to ask you, how does Victoria Nuland get to stay on in the Obama administration?
Well, it's a very good question. Obviously, she was, she was a top aide to Vice President Dick Cheney back during the previous administration. And she's married to Robert Kagan, who's one of the most prominent neocons in Washington. He was one of the two co-founders of the Project for the New American Century, which back in the 1990s devised the regime change approach that the neocons have embraced ever since. And I happen to have known Kagan going back to the Reagan era when he was when I was with the Associated Press and Newsweek, and he was one of the propagandists over at the State Department on Central America, which I was covering at the time. So these folks have sort of long track records in Washington, and I think they're very well connected, and they're very smart, and they continue to play important roles. But Victoria Nuland, I think the real answer to your question is that President Obama, who isn't, I mean, I know some people on the left like to say, well, he must be a neocon too. I think with the truth about Obama, based on my reporting, is that he's sort of a closet realist. He would prefer a more pragmatic approach to foreign policy. He's not an ideologue in the way that the neocons are and the liberal interventionists are. But he's not really willing to take the fight to them. He'd rather try to finesse these things. So when he first took over, he did the so-called team of rivals, if you remember, where he kept Robert Gates, Bush's defense secretary, in place. He brought in Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State, very much a hawkish Democrat, almost virtually a neocon herself. And it was under Hillary Clinton that Victoria Nuland rose from where she had been up to being the spokesman and then nominated to be the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs. And Obama's not been willing to crack any kind of whips over there. He's not been willing to fire people or push them out of their positions. He doesn't want to take on those battles, apparently. So it gives a great deal of freedom to these kind of mischief makers, if you will. They can present themselves as doing things like promoting democracy in places like Ukraine, even though they were involved in overthrowing a democratically elected president. But they can pitch it that way, and Obama doesn't seem to be willing to pay the political capital to stop them. He'd rather try to finesse it, go along with it. Then he kind of joins the stampede of official Washington, and before you know it, the policy's completely gone mad.
Well, some people say that he's afraid of certain repercussions. I think Ray McGovern quoted him as telling some friends that, look what happened to Martin Luther King, although I think JFK might be a better example. But anyway, does Obama have reason to be afraid of anything? I mean, is he even just blackmail or something like that?
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. I think he's fairly, I mean, physically secure as much as any president is. But I think he politically... he's not been willing to take on these fights. And I think to some degree the problem with Obama has been that he's always wanted the approval of people with these credentials, people with PhD after their name, or people that are that write for important magazines or people at big think tanks or, you know, folks like that. He has a misplaced sense of admiration for people with titles. And when you get into the official Washington of the modern era, which it's a very corrupt place, and you don't necessarily rise because you're a good person or a person with strong ethics or anything of that sort. You often rise because you play the game well, and often some of the worst people rise to pretty high levels, as we've seen in the past. So I think he misplaces the sense of who he should admire and respect, but he certainly doesn't want them to turn on him. I think he feels somewhat insecure, even though he's president, in terms of taking on the power structure of Washington. I think either because he doesn't understand how corrupt it is, or because he doesn't have the political courage to deal with it. It's also, he's obviously very busy with many, many, many issues on his plate, and so there's a certain limit of how much a president can actually do. But that's his own fault to a great extent. He never took control of his administration, especially on national security and foreign policy issues. The whole team of rivals thing, which was very applauded in Washington, and which, you know, many of the pundits liked, was really a disastrous idea for him, because it meant that he had these forces, particularly Gates and Clinton, who did not agree with his more pragmatic approach to foreign policy. They wanted to continue to pursue this interventionist approach that pretty much continue what George Bush and Dick Cheney had put together.
Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Robert Perry, who is the publisher of Consortium News and a longtime journalist. And I'd like to talk a little bit about, at one point, you know, Ukraine was sort of, they had two possible deals to help their economy. There was the European Union deal and the Russian deal. And can you tell us briefly how were they different?
Well, basically what happened last year was that the European Union put forward this idea that Ukraine could have an association with the EU. And that sounds good, and many people in Ukraine like the idea. Some of the young people in particular like the idea of not having to get visas to go to Europe, to the Western Europe. And obviously Ukraine's a very poor country. It's a country with tremendous income inequality. You have a handful of oligarchs who sort of scarfed up all the valuable properties and businesses after the Soviet Union collapsed in 91. And then you have a lot of people who don't have much to do. You have some business and industry in the East, but people are pretty hard off in Ukraine. So there was an interest in maybe doing something different. However, along with the EU plan came the International Monetary Fund, which said, okay, as part of this effort to become part of Ukraine, you have to accept our package of, quote, reforms, unquote. And that meant that the lives of the average Ukrainian, already hard as they are, would be made even harder. There'd be they'd lose subsidies on their heating. Their currency would be reduced in value, so their buying power would be less. And at this point, the president Yanukovych, who was actually inclined to go with the EU plan initially, reversed himself, and he turned to Moscow and to President Putin. And Putin offered a $15 billion loan package that didn't have all these it was basically just a straight loan package. And so Yanukovych felt that was better for his country. He was the elected president, and he opted for that. At that point, this is when, with the help of people like Victoria Nuland and Ambassador Pyatt and people like Senator McCain, also the National Endowment for Democracy and some of the NGOs that are funded by the U.S. government, we saw this real push to create a crisis. And some of that was very much was indigenous people just going into the streets, but some of it was also organized. And eventually it took on a life of its own, where we also had some of these neo-Nazi groups showing up with as street fighters, and that's when they went after the government and ultimately overthrew it in February of this year. But the two deals were that the real deal breaker for Yanukovych was not the EU association, but the IMF reforms, that he felt would be very painful to the average Ukrainian.
Now, I hear apparently they've been delayed or something like that. I guess Ukraine is going along with the EU deal, but it doesn't really take effect for us. Is that true? Or am I...
Well, basically, after, you know, it almost looks like one of these classic cases of a coup d'etat, where the United States kind of helps organize something, and then once the people are put in that are favored by the U.S., in this case, people like Yatsenyuk, who was handpicked by Nuland, once they're in, then they push through these packages. And Yatsenyuk did push through, in what's left of the parliament, he pushed through the IMF, quote, reforms. And even Yatsenyuk admitted these were politically devastating and extremely painful to the people of Ukraine, but he did it. And they went ahead and agreed to the European Association, which was just signed recently. But President Poroshenko has delayed its implementation for about a year and a half, at least to the end of 2015, I think it is. So yes, there's a recognition that the economic conditions in Ukraine are in really dire straits, as bad as they were before this coup d'etat in February. They're much worse now.
Well, I read something very recently that the OECD is sort of they slashed their growth forecasts for Europe. They're predicting a 0.8% growth for the Eurozone. So that is actually less than 1% growth. So it seems like the European economy is in really dreadful shape.
Well, this whole situation with Ukraine has been harmful in so many ways. Obviously, most of the Ukrainians and especially people in eastern Ukraine who rose up against the coup regime and have been subjected to essentially a military onslaught from the West. Thousands of people are dead, and hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million or so, have been displaced. So you have a very bad situation in Ukraine, but the disruption of the potential disruption of energy supplies, which now go from Russia transiting Ukraine to Western Europe, that has had a dangerous effect on the European economy, which has just been sort of clawing its way out of what had been a double dip recession, and now is on the verge of being a triple dip recession. There are some of the countries, while maybe across the Eurozone it's a virtual flat line. For some countries, they're sliding back into recession again, and that has created political turmoil across the EU, because you have some countries where you're now seeing right wing and or left wing sort of extremist groups rising up, because the so-called establishment parties have been discredited by their failure to meet the needs of the people. So this whole thing with Ukraine has had many dire effects beyond the geopolitical tensions. There are also these economic fallout.
Well, it sort of makes me wonder: does Europe somehow hope that they'll be kind of like get an economic transfusion out of Ukraine? Are they going to buy up Ukraine on the cheap, or is Ukraine going to drag them down even more? I don't know which way it's going to go.
Well, it looks like it'll probably probably drag them down more. Mm-hmm. There are obviously some companies that are eager to step in and see what they can make out of Ukraine now that it's basically prostrate. There are certain energy companies that want to go in and do fracking. There are natural gas reserves that are believed that can be extracted. There are agricultural companies that see the land in Ukraine as potentially very usable. But basically, much of that could have been done without this crisis. There was no real resistance to that from the Yanukovych government. They were willing to do much of these things. But you probably have some companies that now maybe will get a somewhat better deal, but they'll also be dealing with a country that is very unstable, a population that's been turned against one another, There probably will be much more violence as the future unfolds. Mm-hmm. And all this really could have been averted. This was not something that had to happen. There were many alternatives that were presented, even as late as February 21st. If you remember, there'd been increasing violence in the Maidan. There was these mysterious sniper shootings which were blamed on Yanukovych, but he denied being involved, and other more recent evidence indicated that maybe some of these right-wing extremists in Ukraine actually did it to sort of as a provocation. A number of policemen also were killed, not just demonstrators. But at that point, Yanukovych agreed in a deal brokered by three European governments, France, Germany, and Poland. Yanukovych agreed to move up, first of all, reduce his own powers, and move up elections so he could be voted out of office. And he agreed, with some pressure from the United States, to pull back his police. And it was at that point that some of these neo-Nazi militias that had been organizing in Western Ukraine and had become like the muscle, the so-called self-defense forces of the Maidan, went on the attack and seized a number of government buildings and basically forced Yanukovych's government to flee. Mm. But even as late as February 21st, if the West had insisted that that agreement be enforced rather than just abandoned, this thing could have been solved much more within their constitutional framework, in a much more peaceful way, without turning the West against the East and without Crimea seceding. All this could have maybe been handled, and without the disruptions to the European economy, which will have repercussions for the American economy, since the U.S. Businesses do a lot of commerce with Europe. So all this could have been done, but the people who were driving this, including members of the Obama administration, people like Nuland and Piatt and members of Congress like Senator McCain, they had their ideological agenda apparently, and they were just going to push this until with some desire for a regime change, another sort of neocon-driven regime change. And they got that, but they also got the chaos, which has been the basic story of how the neocons have functioned over the last couple of decades. Wherever they go, wherever they get their regime change, whether it's Iraq or Libya or Ukraine, or they tried to get this in Syria, wherever they seem to go, they leave behind very bloody chaos.
Well, it looks like things are some shaky times ahead, and you're going to be right there to witness it. What's it like being in Washington these days?
Well, you know, Washington's a very strange place because sometimes what is real, what can be reported, what you can find out, is not what people want to believe. And often there's a phrase they love in Washington, which I sort of despise, which is, perception is reality. And Ivo, as a journalist, I hate that idea. Mm-hmm. I think reality is reality. But the thinking is that if everyone perceives something, that makes it real. But as we saw in Iraq in 2003, just because you perceive that there are weapons of mass destruction there doesn't mean there are. And by the time you figure that out, by the time reality reasserts itself, you have hundreds of thousands of dead people. So it's sort of weird to be in a place that thinks it's dealing with reality when often it doesn't.
Well, I hope you stay in there and keep on pushing reality. So we've been talking to Robert Perry, who's the publisher of Consortium News. I really recommend people go to the Consortium News website and read their articles and book deals and everything else. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per.
And stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
2 years ago, Portland lost a musical and cultural icon with the passing of Ghanaian master drummer, bandleader, and teacher Obo Adi. His contribution to the raising of local knowledge and appreciation of African music in general, and Ghanaian music in particular, and his tireless work with local youth cannot be overstated. As part of our fall membership drive, KABU is proud to present a celebration and retrospective of Obo's work on Thursday, October 2nd, from 1 until 4 p.m. Musical offerings, remembrances, and interviews will be part of this important figure's legacy. Join Andy Hosh and DJ Charlie and others at 1 p.m. on Thursday, October 2nd. The preceding hour, from noon until 1 p.m., will be filled with Ghanaian music as part of DJ Charlie's regular World Beat Connection time slot. See you then.
All that coming to you from KBOO Portland, where the time is about 10:01. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints, a report on the cross-country train headed for the Global People's Climate Rally in New York this weekend. Also, activist Harvey Wasserman on the next step in climate change action, and an interview with a psychotherapist and Lyme disease activist on dealing with the illness. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, we hear an interview with Tasmanian writer Richard Flanagan about his latest novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which takes place in 1943 in a Japanese POW camp on the